Hi, and welcome back to the show. Today, I am joined by Sondre Raich. He is the co-founder and CEO of Safety Wing. They are a nomad and remote team insurer. Okay, so it's a little bit left of center for our audience. Stick with us. It's a really great conversation. Sondre is kind of a different thinker. He thinks more broadly about the future of work, the future of global connectivity, and he's looking at building things like the global social safety net and also a concept called the country on the internet. So really interesting conversation, and it's what I enjoy talking about as well, which is kind of like, what is this future of work thing? Where is it all going? What is globalization and what is it all leading to? So I found a lot of this conversation really, really fascinating, and I hope you do too. As always, if you're on any of the show notes, go to outsourceaccelerator.com/podcast. Enjoy. This podcast is brought to you by Outsource Accelerator. We are the world's leading outsourcing marketplace and advisory. We help big and small businesses with their outsourcing needs, and we can help you too. We cover everything from offshore business and staffing strategy, optimal outsourcing structures, implementations, and fully managed services. If you are already outsourcing, about to start, or are somewhere in between, then we can ensure that you get the best from outsourcing. That's the best prices, best terms, and of course, the best results from your offshore operations. The Outsource Accelerator Marketplace now covers over 3,000 outsourcing firms, representing a global workforce of over 5 million people. We also host this leading outsourcing podcast, publish Inside Outsourcing, and have over 15,000 pages of content on the site. Because we span the entire market, we can ensure that you get the best deal possible. Get in touch today. Visit us at outsourceaccelerator.com/quote. Also, if you find this podcast interesting or valuable, please share it. We have now produced hundreds of episodes featuring the outsourcing world's most prominent luminaries. Please show your support by sharing this podcast today. So, Sondre, you're the co-founder of Safety Wing, which I'm going to get you to explain a little bit in a minute. But you really stuck out to me because of the topics we're going to talk about today, things like global social safety net, the future of work, including remote work, country on the internet, and building and scaling a company remotely. All of these things really get me quite excited, if I'm going to be honest. So really excited to have you on board. You are the co-founder and CEO of Safety Wing. So just as background, do you want to give us a little bit of a rundown on what Safety Wing is?
Sure, yeah. So, I mean, if you go to our website, you could buy health insurance for digital nomads or remote teams. And that's a global health insurance that works in any country in the world that are used by digital nomads or remote teams. However, we are what we were made to make is a global social safety net and a country on the internet, ultimately. And what that means, what global social safety net means, is not just health, but also kind of income protection, kind of the welfare state idea. That's sort of what we're building towards. And that's coming along nicely. So soon some big product launches in a not too distant future on both of those fronts. And country on the internet, you know, that's the passport part of it, the citizenship. So we're a startup, we're a company, but we also have like this very unusual, interesting future that hopefully will be realized.
Yeah, it's good introduction. Thank you. Because it puts it in context, like you're initially floating with pretty fundamental products, which is insurance for the global crowd, for the expatriates, for nomads, remote, things like that. But you seem to have a sort of broader remit or a mission, I suppose, in terms of kind of globalizing the world and building that infrastructure for the world and normalizing this kind of global movement. Is that right?
Globalizing, normalizing the global movement. Well, I mean, our hypothesis when we started, which is still my take today, is that the world, in a way, it's already gone global via the internet. And that has changed the sort of constraints of the world that we live in. That's a bit of an abstract word. Now I'm getting into abstract land, so you got to stop because I can quickly...
Let's not go too abstract too quickly, but... Interesting. Look, but I mean, obviously you're helping because a lot of people have gone, let's say, global. They're nomads, they're expats. And up until now, there's not really infrastructure that really supports them, is there? You know, and, you know, everything from you're really going out on your own because you're lacking everything from kind of schooling for children, health insurance, of course, taxation, like easy kind of taxation. Banking can often be difficult. So I suppose if more and more people become kind of globalized, then they're going to need better infrastructure to support that.
Absolutely. I was myself digital nomad, and it says our website made by digital nomads for digital nomads. Definitely have that experience of you move abroad and nothing really works, and you kind of have to solve out all of those basics on your own, and So we're trying to address some of them. When you live in your home, when I live in Norway, where I came from, I can just opt into whatever services I'm kind of default qualify for. But it's common for all digital nomads is that you're not in your home country. And so these basics have to be provided for. So solving for that use case in particular seems right because, it's an opportunity that more and more people have, this possibility to earn money online. Whether a startup or website or full-time remote job, which is becoming increasingly possible, but also online freelancing has been for a while. It's a wonderful thing and it allows people to live abroad, essentially like you do, like I do. And you can just move to your favorite city, essentially, or whether that's Manila, Dubai, or San Francisco. But you do have to solve those basics, and we're trying to solve for at least one part of it.
That's interesting. And on your website you say insurance for people and also teams, and I don't know, not wanting to sort of hijack your business model, but I've always sort of felt that nomads, it's kind of a little bit niche, and it's kind of a little bit fringe in that a lot of people travel in their 20s, but then they kind of grow up in inverted commas and they have children and they settle down and then they don't do the nomadism thing so much. And, it's interesting, but teams, as we've seen from obviously the advent of COVID and everything going remote and now companies showing preference toward remote and global employment, maybe that kind of unlocks incredible sort of TAM where, I think I have a thesis that in 20, 30 years from now, every company in the world will be employing globally. Now, the individuals being employed might not necessarily be nomads, but you need, if you're going to employ globally, you then need a meshwork of global infrastructure, whether it is, employment and contracts and insurance and infrastructure, things like that. Is that kind of part of your thesis as well, or are you...
Yeah,
more sort of catering to the nomad class.
No, that's it. So, when we started with nomads, the reasoning was that, and then we just thought nomads are early adopters, and we know. So, and that's what I think nomads are. It's just they're early adopters of possibility.
Yeah, they're the bleeding edge, aren't they? You are based in SF, which is, the kind of epicenter of evolution and change and innovation. One of the big things to have come out of Silicon Valley recently is EORs, and they are sort of extremely popular, or certainly VCs have jumped on that bandwagon with the likes of Deal and Remote and Omnipresent and potentially sort of Rippling. How do you see those? Are they sort of competitors? Are they consistent with your model? Are they, do they help your model progress, kind of thing?
Yeah. Yeah. The last one. So one of our distribution channels are these kind of EORs. So yeah, so I just saw it, you know, before when we first started out, we actually were trying to get people to start it, what we then described as Gusto for remote. And several people did, and, you know, and they kind of hit the sort of pandemic remote hype and the sort of 2021 fundraising hype cycle just like perfectly. So that would be Deal, Oyster, and remote. And yeah, Deal is significant partners of ours, but all of them are partners in some respect. So yeah, no, they're just another piece of the infrastructure. You know, everything has to be rebuilt for this global economy. Everything that doesn't work, and payroll is one of those things. But you know, we're not doing payroll. We're doing the, like you said, the benefits, the insurance. Although our ambitious stretches beyond that, but in this context, that's our relationship.
And I've been actually traveling around the world since about 20 years old, you know, and when I was 20, I was a kid doing a bit of backpacking. As I get older, you know, I haven't really kind of changed that much, but I suppose I'm now referred to as an expat, you know, and it's semantics largely, but it's effectively, you know, people living offshore and doing business or working in businesses. I have had expat insurance for many years, you know, as I matured and realized actually I need to be careful with health and you can't take it for granted. I went and got expat insurance. And, you know, these are things that kind of lurk in the shadows a bit, but expats have been around for, no idea, you know, 50, 100 years, and there's probably been insurance services for that. Are you really an insurance broker for existing insurance plans, or is it part of your mission to completely rebuild insurance and, you know, build your own book in that regard?
Yeah, we are our own. Like, we're rebuilding the insurance. We're not just brokering the expat one. But, you know, I'm grateful for that existed. That actually makes our job a lot easier because they have, like, regulatory speaking, for example, they have walked up many of those paths that we then had to figure out after them. So, and so that makes it a lot easier to build like what we want or what we have, and certainly, which is a much more, well, sort of global, universal, simple model. So insurance is, it's amazingly rigid and obsolete and complex. Like when you interact with the industry, you know, there's significant parts of the industry, which is still like, they're barely kind of caught up with computers. You know, much less the internet. And it's a slow adopting part of the economy. And so, yeah, there is definitely also a need to make, you know, we are approaching making this product like, so, you know, so simple that, you know, you can put the price on the front page, which we have, which is requires, you know, an amazing amount of simplification. And that goes really deep and it's really necessary. So, yeah, no, we have like, an insurance carrier license, and we develop the products, and we want to make them. I think we might already be the world's simplest insurance, but we certainly want to, but we're barely getting started. Like, it's going to be amazingly simple by the time we're done.
That's interesting. So do you have a flat price, and how do you do that if someone is 70 years old with a heart condition versus someone that's 25 years old, fully fit?
Yeah. We don't have a fully flat price. We're striving towards a fully flat price. No, we do have some age bands still. So we have a wide age band that covers a lot of our customers because so many of our customers are in their 30s. So we, you know, the age band is 18 to 40, and then it goes in decades after that. So we haven't been able to fully flatten it, but for sort of 95% of buyers, it is flat, but we flatten it across countries. We've removed many of the things that might make the pricing harder to tell what it is. Like, yeah, so, but yeah, in the future, hopefully we can also take out the age band, but for now we have age bands.
Well done. It's a big mission, huh? And, you know, talking more abstract, I suppose, like what is your vision for the future then of the future? You talk, you know, about global social safety nets, you talk about country on the internet. Like, what do you mean by country on the internet?
Well, I mean, in our case, it's just a bundle, citizenship as a service, consisting of one part is the social safety net. So that I imagine that you pay $2.99, hopefully, per month, and you get sort of health, but also all the income protection, meaning disability, unemployment, parental leave, etc., etc., and so community. So that's like this global social safety net, and it works anywhere in the world, and it's really good and simple. And then the other part is a passport. So essentially, you, when we are ready, you will get a passport that is actually more than a passport. It's an identification document, yes, but it's actually a multi-country visa. So we're building here on top of a success that we were so fortunate to get, which is this adoption of Nomad visas. So the quick story here is Web Summit in 2019. We didn't invent Nomad visas, but we really popularized it and at a very crucial time, the idea of Nomad visas. So at Web Summit in 2019, we did a talk, and we talked about how in the future, countries and cities will compete for these digital nomad citizen and internet companies, and that they should adopt and try to succeed in this new, because the ones who adopted early would succeed. And we said, and we specifically suggested, by implementing nomad visas for digital nomads. And in the audience was this guy from Barbados, and he went back 6 months later, COVID hit. And so he sent a letter to his government suggesting that they implement nomad visas to kind of save their tourist dependent economy. And they did in 2 months. And now 85 countries have copied Barbados, implemented this. Latest, like Japan last week, big countries. And we got ownership of this idea. So last spring, we were invited to the United Nations to speak, like to the General Assembly, about this idea. And so our plan for internet country visa is that you essentially can get as your second citizenship, sort of your online country, and you would apply to our website, but it would be even more than a passport. It would also be a multi-country visa to kind of like Schengen for countries with nomad visas.
Right.
Schengen, yeah.
Yeah, that'd be great. Gosh, just to simplify all of that.
Yeah.
Amazing. Interesting. And, you know, they say the future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed. And I get a sense with that, you know, like you and I are fairly familiar, it seems, with traveling around a bit, you know, having multiple kind of home countries and the ins and outs of navigating all of that. Whereas still, you know, a lot of people, is it most people in the US don't have a passport? Fundamentally, most people in the US don't ever leave the US. And just the US alone, you know, and you might also be, you know, it'd be interesting to get your opinion on this, having come from Norway, but the US is 50 very distinct states with very distinct rules. And so it's even hard to do business across the US when you're dealing with different sales taxes, different employment implications and stuff like that. You know what I mean? Like in some ways, it's so easy to look at the broad picture. And I really believe that we're all going to be one happy kind of interchangeable world one day. But then when you zoom in on some things, gosh, it's still very pocketed, isn't it? And, you know, like states can't even agree on sort of having unity and alignment on a lot of basic concepts.
Yeah. You know, I think that we're kind of halfway through a transition, let's say a 50-year transition. And this is going to, I think it's going to feel for like ordinary people a little bit sudden once you get adoption, kind of hits this deep part of the S-curve. You know, when I first came to the U.S., a lot of places didn't accept card. And the ones that did, it was like, felt super unsafe. It was just like very old, weird looking machines. And then, you know, while I lived there, over the first couple of years, due to, in particular, I would say Square, but also Square and others like it, suddenly everyone had these like super fancy payment machines. And that seemed like it was just stuck in time when I first arrived there. But then once it became simple enough and easy enough to adopt, you know, all the Americans adopted. And Square, you know, Square just completely circumvented the whole old payments thing, right? They just essentially connect you to an online payment account. And so that means you can use your phone, right? And you can, you know, reduce the cost of accepting card payments a lot and other options except Square. But, you know, it's really Square who did the breakthrough. So I think it will be a similar thing here, right? So it's like in the beginning, it is these, you know, tech savvy early adopters, digital nomads. But over the, like, we're already seeing, you know, our product become more and more simple. And I think there's going to be a transition where very similar as we've seen in other internet industries. So a lot of industries used to be that are now kind of sort of where they have the internet companies that are dominating. They used to have national markets. I'm trying to think of some examples now, but okay, two really weird ones came to mind. One is music and the other is CRMs. So music, prior to Spotify in Norway and many other countries, you actually had a national streaming company. And before that, of course, you had CDs and stuff. But, and I'm sure the regulations, you know, seemed impenetrable. And it was weird how long that took, the kind of fights with the industry fighting back, you know, from Napster on. But eventually Spotify came, and now that all seems like ancient history, doesn't it? Like Spotify.
Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, I travel around a lot, and, you know, maybe I set up my Apple account in Australia and I set up my, I don't know, Amazon account in the UK, and now I live in the Philippines. And it's incredible the stuff I don't have access to, because, I can't buy books in the Philippines because the license doesn't extend to the Philippines, and I can't watch some movies on Netflix because it's in Australia. And it's amazing. All of these things are individually carved out agreements between individual countries. You know, it's amazing, isn't it? You know, but I suppose for the vast majority of people, it doesn't actually, you know, kind of the nomad class is only 0.01%, I assume. So people see this just as kind of normal,
I think so. I think that you will break through that. Well, I mean, that's up to us to do, and in some sense we're already, I mean, it's easier for us than it was for Netflix and Spotify to basically solve the sort of national mosaic because of expat insurance, essentially. That was sort of what I alluded to earlier. They've kind of they did some of the work, which makes it, will make it faster for us to offer well-functioning global insurance. Right. But so I mean, I think the way this will, essentially everyone will go global, like you say, and that will extend pretty deep, including to industries that are today not global, like insurance, like banking, like government services to some degree, not fully. I still think that the countries will continue as they are now, will continue to exist, but there will be a reshuffling of tasks and services that you, where you expect to get them from, because the sort of global internet providers will be so much better at some of those things that for most of the population, they'll get it from the internet products instead of the countries.
Yeah. And, you know, one big, because I talk mostly about employment, global employment, offshoring, and I believe that we're going to eventually have sort of a globalized employment concept, when maybe our children's children are employing people, they're going to think on a global level. They're not going to hire locally anymore because, you know, just everything is run in forums and across digital interfaces. So the local, the value of local diminishes and the value of global increases. But, you know, labor laws are phenomenally complex. And, you know, as I mentioned before, even within the US, you know, and I think when the whole COVID thing happened and workers started to go remote, I think Facebook was, you know, all those Silicon Valley companies, as people flooded out of the expensive California into neighboring states, apparently that is highly illegal because then the right taxes aren't being paid or levied, or, you know, there's different employment laws. And it's really, really complicated. And once you extend that across the whole world, you know, when you have a global team of employees, you know, maybe one's in France, one's in the Philippines, one's in the US, you have, you know, potentially identical employees doing identical roles, but very different labor arrangements depending on the country that they're domiciled in. And it kind of gets complicated, yeah?
Yeah. So no, I love this topic, and I've been working on it for many years. My previous company was a freelancer platform, so we kind of had to figure it out there as well. And well, I mean, if you zoom out, just snapshot, like, how does it distribute today? The majority is, I would say, it's the contractor option, right? I don't know what share. It's at least 60%. Maybe it's 90. Let's say it's 60 to 90% of people who work online remotely, either as full-time or not full-time. This is the most common method. And then you have the EURs. And the EURs, you know, just their pitch. And I don't mean them to throw shade of them, but their pitch is that they reduce risk for the company. But they also invite them into it, because, you know, someone hired an EUR in Greece is still actually hired in Greece, kind of. And that means subject to their labor laws, but they don't necessarily know what they are, you know, even barely. And they, you know, in some countries, they can be quite creative. So that's that. And then you have this, you know, idea of, you know, setting up an entity everywhere in the world. I think that what's happening here is very similar to what happened in other industries. This is just the economy adapting to the internet labor market. So if you think back to the 2000s, there was a big problem that sounded very similar, which had to do with products. So there was a bunch of lawsuits. There was a bunch of like big cases. EU had a whole thing that actually ended up taking quite a bit of the lead on it. But it was about the same question. It's like, hey, if I buy a digital product from you, but I'm, you know, here, I'm in San Francisco, but, you know, you're in Manila, where am I buying it? Right? And what they ended up is essentially, because you can imagine, well, if it's where the buyer is, that means any internet company that sells a digital product has to have a company everywhere in the world. Right. But yeah, you can't just wave that away and say, well, obviously it's not that either. But anyway, that's kind of where you landed. That was that, well, I guess it has to be where the seller is. So it's like, legally speaking, what everyone concluded on was, provided your servers are there. And then that was when they introduced this idea where it became important where your servers are. Your servers are there, you know, essentially it's like, I'm sending you a letter on the internet and you're fulfilling this service, you know, in your country. Yeah. So, but a lot of the legislation isn't made for this situation at all, right? So it's always awkward. In terms of how I think it will end, I don't think the EUR solution will succeed because it's too expensive. So I think it's useful for, you know, its purpose, obviously, and, you know, but it adds, the cost adding is significant. It's like, I don't know what it is on average, maybe 50% or something. It's a significant wedge. And then there's also the, you know, let's see how it plays out with the host countries, because in many countries, the kind of category of EORs, or staffing companies, as they're often called, is actually controversial in some countries. They're seen as a way for people to get around labor laws.
Right. Okay. Well, if they are contracting, yeah. I can't imagine if they're actually employed under the EOR, then they're then complying with the labor laws. I think the big issue is if people are contract within an economy, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that happens a lot in the Philippines. Like, you know, and most people come, not most, there's a certain band of employer entrepreneur that comes to the Philippines employing people on a contract basis. And I don't know whether they're not aware or whether they don't want to be aware, but that is not actually a legal solution. You cannot contract people full-time. That's the case in most countries. You cannot have a full-time contract in the US and forgo the employment obligations and just say, well, they're actually contractors. You know, there are a set of laws to protect employees in that regard. And it's the same in the Philippines, but people don't seem to care, because there's no recourse if, you know, the employer is in the US or the UK or Australia and just sending money across, then no one's there to either police it or, you know, enforce it. So it's becoming a bit of a difficult problem.
It is a key difference. So if someone were to go to the Philippines, clearly is not legal, right? So it doesn't matter that they're from another country. But if someone is sitting abroad, there is precedent on it. So it's not just that they can't enforce it. So for example, if you go to Norway, like it's a separate export category called consulting services abroad.
Right. Okay.
This typically is regulated, but incredibly lightly and incredibly positively, you know, compared to local labor laws, which are very much set to avoid, like, you know, exploitation of the labor or the people, the workers. But this is more seen as like this like high-end export category. Mm. Take Norway as an example. You know, it's pretty lucrative. It actually even used to be like VAT free. They actually just changed that. So now if you're selling services on Upwork, they auto add VAT. But yeah, in theory, that category is wholly exempt, actually, from the Norwegian labor law.
Interesting. Yeah, it is. It would be interesting to look at other more developed economies that have really developed regulation around this and what their perceptions have been, because the Philippines is really sort of just, you know, turn a blind eye, see no evil, hear no evil kind of thing. And I think because, right, you know, it brings a lot of money into the economy. None mm-hmm. of those people are actually paying taxes. None of them are actually properly employed, but it's bringing a lot of money into the economy, which is then being re-spent and stuff like that, you know, whereas otherwise they wouldn't have that money. So it's a double-edged sword for the country. But, you know, the problem is it starts off fairly innocently with, you know, getting someone to do a few logos on Upwork. But what you're effectively now getting is call centers or outsourcing firms that are registered in the US, and then they are employing, you know, 100, 200 people informally in the Philippines and not paying the taxes, not having to abide by labor laws in terms of, you know, how they redundate them or let them off and all of that sort of stuff. And then the employees, they're not getting any of the benefits or taxes paid or SSS and PagiBig and things like that. And, you know, when you scale these things, it can become an issue. And it's actually hard to police that, because who do you go after? You know, it's very difficult.
I mean, it's hard to police, but it's also hard to think of what is the right, because you can imagine a scenario where Philippines could effectively say that anyone who hired a Filipino person as a contractor that is a foreign firm on the internet have to, let's say, establish an entity according to all the rules in Philippines. I think that, and let's say that you just imagine a scenario where they can effectively place that. I don't think, like, very few companies would actually do that. It would just be that they would essentially shut themselves out of that global labor market.
Exactly. Like, and, you know, this is the problem. It's not illegal for the US company to do it from the US. It's just that it's not a legal form of employment in the Philippines. You know, and it would be interesting to see what happens if it was reversed in the US. Like, you know, how, if I wanted to hire 100 US people and I just kept them on a basic contract without any of their rights and not paying any of the taxes, how would that wash out? You know, it's sort of interesting to...
On contractor basis, that's established in most countries. So if an individual in the US, you know, you can work, sell services to a Filipino company, but you can't, you still have to pay taxes for that. But you do that as a contractor. It's like, it's a whole, you know, its own system for that. It's similar to the Norwegian one, many others I know. So you can, but so most
what
of
I understand about contractors, you have to have multiple forms of income, don't you? Because it's to protect the employee, saying, you know, the employer could just say, you're not an employee, you're a contractor, but I'm contracting you for 40 hours a week, but I don't have to pay you any of the benefits. And in order to prevent that from happening, they say if you are actually a contractor, you have multiple clients and not one of them just takes up 40 hours of regular employment, because then if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it is a duck. It's employment. And you know what I mean?
Yeah. So but for international, the employment category doesn't work. So it's like, you could say that's illegal. So it's illegal for you, for a Filipino, to be hired in a US corporation as a full-time employer.
Well, it's not illegal, but it's not illegal for, it's not legal.
Not a legal category.
Yeah.
So that is different here. The international difference here is Israel. But one is like, what is illegal and, you know, and but how will it play out? Like I said, if some country were to then effectively police that, I think that a more interesting one is like, what kind of legislation can actually work given that we're likely to enter this globalized economy? You know, and one version is the sort of one you get to the product one, where it's just, we just all agree that, you know, as one of them, maybe it's the host country and people make new employment categories for non-nationals. That's one direction you can imagine evolving. Another one is that we sort of build on the contractor idea. And this is actually one if I were to put money on it, I would say this. So you can imagine saying that we build from the contractor idea. And we've already seen some developments in this direction, but you make it more like regular employment. So you have to create your own entity if you work for a foreign company. But there, let's say that Norway were to create a new one, which is not regular self-employed. It's just called freelancer. And maybe it comes with, you know, some requirements on the contract. Maybe it comes with auto deduction of taxes, like all regular full-time employees do. You know, you just basically put some of these things in, but in a way that, but it still is, it builds from the contractor model instead of from the personal employment model. That would be my, if I was in some Belgian government somewhere, I think that's probably where I would start. That's likely to work.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? It is, look, it's really complicated, but it's something because, you know, partly what we're seeing here is there's a lot of resistance from it because the outsourcing firms are a very established industry with, you know, properly employing about 1.5 million people, contributing about 12% to the country's GDP. It's the single biggest sector in the country. But what you have is if an outsourcing firm is set up legitimately and they're registered in the Philippines and they hire the people in the Philippines and they do everything correct, then their costs are about 20 to 30% higher than those that don't do it. And they have to comply with all the labor laws. It's very strict. They end up in court if they abuse people or don't give them the right notice periods, redundancies, things like that. You know, so it creates this unlevel playing field. And if you have a path of least resistance where, hey, I can save 30%, I don't have to abide by the labor laws. I can do whatever the hell I want. I don't need to provide health insurance. Like, why would not everyone do that? You know what I mean? And you would have to argue, and I'm not, you know, necessarily a huge socialist. I am a capitalist fundamentally, but you have to assume that those labor laws are there for some reason. Otherwise, just delete them all and no one has to employ anyone kind of thing. You know, so it is an interesting. And this is the interesting thing about globalization, you know, and I've read a lot of books in terms of, you know, tax havens and transferring money and billionaires, you know, pretty much off the grid. It enables the savvy to kind of evade well-meaning systems, doesn't it? You know what I mean? Like you probably notice this as well. When you are international, you almost don't fit into one system. So you can actually avoid all of the systems, which is interesting, but then the systems themselves can break down if too many people start avoiding all of the systems.
Yeah. But I unfortunately think that toothpaste is actually, you're not going to get it back in the tube, because if you think that's bad, like think about company registration, which I've already seen in the digital nomad community. They've figured that out long ago, which is that if you have an internet company, you can kind of domicile it anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's completely fine. You're a digital product and you're a digital.
Yeah.
You can domicile.
This whole thing of evasion is actually probably, you know, I'm just thinking through it now, but it's probably a good forcing function for all of the systems to get more transparent, easier, and more universal. Yeah. Because when you are sort of isolated, you can have all these quirks and you can force your population to comply. Whereas if people sort of float above it and enough people float above it, then the system has to go, hey, this system isn't working. We need to make it easier to get into. You know, business registration's the same. Like, you know, you can, I think in the US, you can just register online in, you know, 5 minutes. Whereas in the Philippines, it takes 9 months. And that's part of the problem, you know, and costs you a lot of legal fees. And then it's a pain in the bum to manage. And that is exactly why people don't incorporate here and employ people properly is because there's just so many disincentives. So it shines a light on these inefficient systems. Yeah.
Yeah, it does. And that's an upside that will come from this. I mean, there is certainly some truth to that. Many countries, their ability to tax and maybe even regulate in some case is maybe above what people would tolerate if they had an option. And so what happens then when the option introduced? You know, there is one, when I was younger, my dad was in shipping, which is a big industry in Norway. And they had a similar industry, you know, a situation 140 years ago when steamships were invented. And so before that, you know, it was like other industries. You had like shipping companies in most countries that, you know, provided shipping services. And then around the 1900 turn of the century, then a lot of them seemed to discover at the same time that, hey, we have this boat and it goes between two international locations. And I'm here, you know, employing, you know, Norwegians, right? And paying taxes in Norway. But this boat has never been to Norway, right? And they sort of realized that almost in a big go. And then it was this period where first some did it and then a lot of people did it. It took still a few decades, but they essentially then made an entity for their boat elsewhere, and some locations really kind of captured most of them. Only a couple of countries reacted in time. So one of them was actually Norway and Greece, which both has been mentioned. And that was because they had such a large share of their economy was from this industry. So they essentially just carved out like this. So it became this new thing called a flag rule. So they carved out and they said, you can stay in Norway, but you're exempted from Norwegian labor law and you also pay basically zero taxes.
Right,
okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think there is something to this. Like the internet economy has the same feature that the ships had, which is that it's already happening internationally, maybe even between two places, which isn't even the host country. So you can actually register this entity anywhere. And if what we're seeing in the digital nomad and remote community is exactly that, which is that there's a disproportionate amount of the remote startups are being registered in places like Singapore or Estonia, previously a lot in Hong Kong as well. So you had these like places that became very popular to register, which have very favorable regulatory rules and tax rules.
It's fascinating, isn't it? I've read a couple of books on Delaware actually, and you know, obviously that's very popular in the US, but some refer to it as the world's biggest tax haven, and it's, you know, completely onshore and in, you know, in plain, hidden in plain sight. But it's pretty interesting, you know, it's kind of a one-upmanship of all of these, a little bit maybe like Greece and Norway, in terms of you just make the rules so that you make the participants happy, but it becomes competitive, you know, and Delaware is competing against all these other states and potentially kind of lowering the bar. But again, this is just all, it's all interesting competition, isn't it, in terms of balancing the needs and interests of the user versus the other party. It's kind of a fascinating thing. You know, I suppose conjunct to that is taxation, like, you know, right, one of the most complicated things ever. And do you think that will be simplified? Do you think that'll be kind of universal ever? Or is that always going to be highly complex and highly stratified?
No, I mean, I do think that the internet companies and the digital nomads will force. It won't feel like force. It will feel like some countries successfully competing, but the end result, I think, will be that you get a sort of some what feels like competition on the taxation ability, which will reduce some countries' ability to tax, I think. I don't think there's any way around that, unless there's some other effect, some network effects or services effect that is just so strong that you can, you know, get high tax jurisdictions that still attract a lot. I mean, I would kind of call US that. US is kind of high tax. You know, we are technically in Delaware, but we're not really exempt from almost any taxes because we're headquartered in California and we pay full taxes here. Anyway, it's actually a very high tax. As a corporate jurisdiction, it's actually one of the highest taxes in the world. But yeah, so I'm curious how that will play out. But if I, all else being equal, my hunch is that we sort of have monopoly pricing going on right now. And once you lift the monopoly, you find a new taxation level, and it's going to be a lot less than today for this sort of digital nomad internet company setup, which is that doesn't matter when it's 0.1%. But what if internet companies become 50% of the economy or something? You know, maybe it's significant. Then you might have countries like really adopt and adjust. And you have like, actually, if I were to guess, I don't see how they get out of that dynamic. So I think that the taxation ability will fall and that you will have some countries that will capture a large share of the residents and the corporations as almost the entire world economy move into the kind of internet globalized marketplace.
I certainly think the formula for calculating these things fundamentally has to change, doesn't it? And, you know, as you say, like there's these internet companies and digital economy that, you know, the taxation system was kind of built when you're dealing with factories, which are very firmly planted in one location. And the whole kind of formula calculation was based off of that. And they sold to one market. And it's got to change, isn't it? Like whether you're dealing with sort of point of sale taxation or consumption taxes, but it's these things are too hard to track otherwise. So it'll be fascinating to see how it evolves.
Yeah.
One last question. And, you know, then we'll probably wrap up. But in a simplistic form, I think that we're heading towards kind of a singularity in terms of the whole world is getting more homogenized. Like we're all watching YouTube, we're all watching Netflix, you know, for better or for worse, a lot of cultures are being kind of homogenized and westernized. And I think the same with systems, things will simplify, things will globalize, blah, blah, blah. But you know, the other argument is that sort of giant China's, you know, pulling apart. Before we used to be friends, now we're not. Russia's not friends. Even in the US, you've got all these states making different laws and kind of polarizing. Do you think, you know, in 50 to 100 years, we become sort of one unified blob? Or do you think that it's possible that individualism gets more extreme and pocketed in a future world?
Yeah. Well, I think we're actually close to maxing out, I think, on that axis of the blob. So I had this conversation with someone yesterday where they're like, they said this, which is a trope. I'm sure you've heard it, like, oh, people say it in America, like, oh, America doesn't have any culture. And this other person had this take, which is like, actually, there is no other culture. It's not like
Right. Everyone's
living in America. They were watching Netflix and YouTube and, you know, listening to American artists and what else is there actually? And I thought that was an interesting exchange. There is this flattening that's been going on for a good while, and it's really accelerated by the internet and just everyone having a smartphone and consuming the same stuff. And this universal culture is emerging, which isn't, it's not strictly American, but it is certainly westernized, and it is does pick up international stuff in it. You know, you will have things go very big, you know, in the same way that, you know, like sushi is a popular, you know, dish worldwide. You have this similar thing where like there are ideas that can come from anywhere, you know.
Yeah. It's more just the speed of proliferation of it, isn't it? You know, and the speed of conduction of an idea or a thing or a trend, it can cross the globe in milliseconds, you know, on these platforms like TikTok and stuff. So I suppose it's the
But in terms of how it's play out, I think that, well, the blob has an existential risk to it, which is that, you know, if everyone thinks the same and we're all in the same pond, and then like something massive changes in the environment, we sort of all go extinct at the same time. You know, that's the evolutionarily downside of homogeneity. So that is a little bit concerning. I also do think that I do think we will in some sense become like one human. We will certainly get like, I do think that we'll see the advent of internet countries. I don't think that's just safe doing. I think that that's sort of something that's bound to happen, and that we will get this sort of global identity and something. It's not going to be global. It's going to be like specifically something, but you know, it's maybe it even feels like a product, but that grows up to the level of feeling like nation states used to be. But I do think that you kind of turn the corner and then you will have people create new communities. So if I were to put in one prediction, I think you will have this proliferation of something like, I don't know what we will call them, but it will be something like moral communities where people eventually become so similar, and then they kind of have built the tools to also build new groups. So that would be my guess. And that the future actually will be divided, but it will very likely be divided along something like value lines or preference lines, geographically overlapping instead of sort of country, nation states lines.
Yeah. Well, fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for sharing your insights. And it's really good to talk over this. And I think more people should be talking about this. It's good to have this as a North Star, isn't it, in terms of kind of increased globalization and connectivity. I think there's an inevitability about it. But in the meantime, people should check out Safety Wing, of course. And how can they find out more about that if they want?
Definitely go to safetywing.com if you want to pay attention to the Internet Country Project password in particular. That's plumia.org, our sort of nonprofit arm. And you can sign up to a newsletter there. That would probably be the best way.
That was Sondre Raiche. He is the co-founder and CEO of Safety Wing. As always, if you want any of the show notes, go to outsourceaccelerator.com/podcast. And as always, if you want to email us, send us an email to ask@outsourceaccelerator.com. See you next time.